Welcome to How I Lawyer, a podcast where I talk to attorneys from throughout the profession about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. I'm your host, Jonah Perlin, a law professor in Washington, D.C. This episode is sponsored, edited, and engineered by my friends at LawPods. LawPods is a professional podcast production company focused solely on attorney podcasting. I absolutely love working with them, and if you're considering becoming a legal podcaster or just want to learn more, check them out at lawpods.com. And now, let's get started. Hello and welcome back. In today's episode, I'm excited to speak with Mike Spivey, who is the founding partner and CEO of the Spivey Consulting Group and previously served as a senior level administrator and admissions dean at Vanderbilt University, Washington University in St. Louis, and the University of Colorado. Mike's an expert on law school admissions and rankings and all things law school, frankly, and has been a featured panelist and speaker on the subject. In addition to his law school work, he hosts the Status Check with Spivey podcast. He's a graduate of Vanderbilt University, from which he holds a BA and a doctorate in education. Go Commodores, and the University of Alabama, where he earned his MBA, Roll Tide. And after learning a little bit about Mike, I'm excited to chat with him about three topics near and dear to both of our hearts, which are mental health, law school admissions, and law school rankings. So welcome to the podcast, Mike. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. I have a feeling that Roll Tide just sort of comes off the tongue better than the Go Commodores. I hear the Roll Tide much more often.
Yeah, you know, you're a podcaster also, so you know, you got to have like what your shtick is. And from day one, my shtick has been college mascots, and I'm sticking with it. So
what's the most unique mascot you've done for?
That's a good question. I think I remember the one where I said the mascot from the university, but actually the law school had a wholly different mascot and the guest had to correct me live. The University of Vermont and the University of Vermont Law School do not share a mascot for some reason. So you learn something new every single day. Enough about me. Let's talk about you, Mike. You're one of my rare guests on the show who doesn't have a JD, but you've done a lot of work for quite some time with law schools and law students. Talk to me a little bit about how you got here and your path to sort of working in this space and doing so at such a high level as you have for so many years.
Started when I was in my early 20s. I was in business school and I had a philosophy degree with a focus on ethics. And then a business degree, and their business ethics professor up and left. And so the University of Alabama, Roll Tide for you, was in desperate need of a business ethicist, of which I wasn't, but I had the background to teach. The funny thing about that, Jonah, was I was so young that on the first day of class, I just sat in the seats with the students and they listened to them like murmur, when is the professor going to? And then I stood up and went to the front of the classroom, and it was pretty awkward, but worked. So I fell in love with higher ed. I went to Vanderbilt to get my doctoral degree. And as part of that doctoral process, I know you know this, they pay you, but you have to work. And what they had me doing was reading admissions files at the law school. So that was my little part-time gig. And I got to know the dean of the law school, Kent Siverud, so well, and he took me under his wing as a mentor that I switched full-time to admissions. And that became my new passion.
Wow, what a fascinating and sort of random path to what you ended up doing for many, many years after that.
I think for so many of us, our paths are pretty random when I think about it.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I've done over 130 of these interviews, and if, you know, I've learned a lot of lessons, but one commonality, absolutely, and I say this all the time, is careers only make sense looking backwards, not looking forwards, because there's some random moment, some relationship, something that chained us that made it happen. So I think that's cool. So the first topic I want to talk about is admissions, which is obviously something you know a lot about and have been doing for a long time. And frankly, it's been a while since I was in the law school admissions game for myself, and I don't play a role at all in admissions as a law school professor. And I have a mix of listeners of this podcast, right? I have people who are pre-law, who are thinking about going to law school, all the way up to people who have been practicing for many, many years. Talk to me a little bit about what law school admissions looks like today and maybe some of the differences from ways it's been in the past.
It's not just radically different, obviously, from 2009 when you were submitting paper apps and we were getting paper truckloads of mail for applications. It's radically different since last year. The last year has seen the most change in admissions in the 26 years I've done admissions. Our firm collectively has over 250 years experience, and we all agree this was like the most change we've ever seen. So why was that? Well, one reason, which I know you know, is this was the SCOTUS decision. I do think people misinterpret often how SCOTUS impacted the admissions process. Schools have always wanted to know about people's backgrounds. As long as I've been doing this, we've cared about people's backgrounds. Schools still care about your background. But after the SCOTUS decision and the wording of the rendering, you no longer can ask questions that previously you could. You have to word things a lot differently. So what did that do? The downstream consequences were, when you applied, and you'll remember this, applications were pretty uniform. You write your personal statement, you do your resume, and maybe you do one optional essay. Because of the SCOTUS decision, schools were left scrambling. They can't talk to one another about how they're going to do the applications. So they came up with, you know, there's 190 new essays that happened in 1 year. That has tremendously slowed down admissions. Whereas in previous years, you apply in September, maybe you hear back in October, November, or December. Now you apply in September because it's taking longer to do your applications. There's such a diversification of essay questions. And because it's taking admissions offices, you know, they've never read these answers before because there are new questions. So the cycle is by far the slowest. I would say, I'm not kidding you, 50% of admits are still out there, still coming.
Right.
And we're in March.
We're in March. Yeah. I mean, that is a big difference. And just to like drill down a little bit, when you say they are different questions, are most of them sort of all trying to get at the same thing, which is about people's personal backgrounds in a more nuanced way as driven by the Supreme Court's affirmative action jurisprudence? Is that the driving force?
That's a great way to piggyback on the second radical change, which was the U.S. News boycott. And what the U.S. News boycott did is you can no longer use private data, so you have to submit public data. And U.S. News had to make some changes, and they greatly diminished the input of the LSAT and the GPA versus past years. Let me explain, because few people realize how much it's been diminished. In the past, obviously, like you're Georgetown, Dean Kornblatt, if he goes up +1, +2 LSAT, you're probably going to go up in the rankings. If he goes up +3, you're definitely going to go up in the rankings. Now, I mean, we model this stuff because we do rankings. If Georgetown were to go up +5 on the LSAT, it wouldn't move your ranking.
Wow, that's a big change, massive change.
So how does that relate to both SCOTUS and the application process? The applications now, they do dig into your background in different ways, but they also dig into like much more your cultural fit with the school, your employability by the school, because the medians don't really matter nearly as much. So schools can ask things like, and this is a real question I heard. This was an interview question, and thank goodness I wasn't the applicant. You find yourself alone on an island with your favorite book. How did you get to the island? What happened? So it's a misdirection question, right?
I feel like I'm like in a McKinsey interview or something in order to answer that question. Like that's so fundamentally different from how we've traditionally thought about like law school admissions.
I love that one. Your mind is like, oh, what's my favorite book? What's my favorite book? And all of a sudden your life would be like, how did I get marooned on this island?
There's something very lawyerly about that, though. It's like, keep your eye on the ball. There might be facts that are extraneous. Like, don't fill in the question. Don't fight. I mean, as a professor, I say this all the time. Don't fight the hypo. Like, figure out what the question is and then answer it.
So much better than the McKinsey's, like, here's a gumball with, you know, how many gumballs are in this canister? Like, I hated that stuff.
Right. Or like, how many quarters fit in a 747? And it's like, okay, come on, man. Like, this is crazy. I mean, frankly, I like was prepared for this interview, and that is even a bigger change than I would have expected as somebody who like feels like I'm generally plugged into the legal world. Are there others besides the rankings? I mean, those are big ones, but the rankings and the GPA LSAT data that are changing the way admissions is happening?
I do think that interviews this cycle, how you interview is going to, I mean, we've used the word holistically for many years in admissions. But now you really can look at someone holistically. So if you're on the borderline and you interview really well and the school says, this person's employable, or this person is just, our faculty are just going to really relate to this person. They're going to make it a great alumnus. They're going to add to the culture. That person is much more likely to be admitted than waitlisted in the past because the school was desperately getting a hold of their medians And until the meeting is solidified, that person might not ever have heard from back to school.
And how is that changing your recommendation for pre-law students thinking about applying this cycle and in the next couple of cycles? How does the advice change from advice that some of us would have given 5 years ago?
So for 25 years, I've been saying, go get an extra LSAT point. It's September. Don't worry. Retake the LSAT. You get three. Take it again. Take it again. And there's so much bad advice out there now, archaic echoes from past years. If you can get higher on the LSAT, sit out this cycle and apply next cycle. That's like a classic mythology online. There's a couple problems. One is schools don't care as much. The second problem, and if you think about it, it makes sense, is we don't know how competitive next cycle is. No one does. You can't predict how many, right? So your 1 point higher LSAT next cycle might actually be lower than your one less LSAT this cycle relative to the applicant pool competition. So in previous years, we really hammered, like, get your highest score. Now, I mean, I still would love for applicants to get their highest score, of course. But now it's take your time, slow it down, and come up with the best possible essays. Make sure you prepare for interview. Don't just go in there blind. Like, you know, you and I have podcasted for years and you do an exceptional job. We both prepared a little bit for this. We didn't just go in blind. In the law school applicant who hasn't done this 1,000 times, they should do 60 mock interviews before they do the real one, because that lever now is supersized for law school admissions versus 2 years ago.
Wow. I mean, we could keep drilling on that, because I think it's actually in some ways very similar to the advice and what I'm hearing from my colleagues who do career services and what big firms are looking for example. The interview becomes that much more important, and practicing the interview. I mean, I don't even remember. I don't think I had more than one, if any, law school interviews at all in 2008, 2009. And it sounds like that's a humongous part of the process now. And I'm also thinking that, you know, we've seen a lot of grade inflation at undergraduate institutions. So maybe the GPA number also means less. Is that right?
It means less in the rankings, and it means less because it's less differentiating. When everyone has a 3.9, by definition, if you have a 3.9, you're not going to differentiate. So for the exact reason you astutely brought up, that's yet another reason why essays matter more. Experience, not just essays, but what's behind the essay. What is your experience behind the essay? You can write the best, it was dark and stormy night, 2 pages of all time. But if it's not about your life experience, you're not going to get admitted. So it's who you are matters a lot more now than what numbers you have, more so than ever before.
Wow. I mean, that also puts a push, as you pointed out, right? Puts a real burden on admissions offices, because that's a lot harder, that review. And that comparison is much harder to do than a much more sort of quote unquote data, quote unquote objective, although those were never objective numbers, review, right?
There used to be these things called the right angle of death. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
If you looked at the scatter plot of school admits by LSAT and GPA, you could see where they just literally, like, if you didn't have that LSAT and GPA, and now that thing is rounded. It's not a right angle.
Fascinating. Wow. I guess last question on admissions is about sort of what students are looking for, because I know you work with a lot of students. And, you know, we talked a little bit about what schools are looking for, but something I've noticed in my sort of Gen Z students that are in my classroom is they are asking different kinds of questions, and frankly, asking more questions about what they want to do in the legal workforce. I'm curious if you've seen law students ask, or pre-law students asking, different questions about what law school to attend.
Yeah, like one big one, and I'm glad we're going to talk about it, is schools' ability to strengthen mental health, how in tune they are with sort of accessibility for students, mental health access for students. Another one, of course, is debt aversion. The cost of tuition has outpaced inflation. Every year that goes by, you have more debt-averse students. There's much more information online about how much debt impacts people. So when you applied, maybe there was like one or two blogs on, hey, you don't want to get stuck in a job you don't like for half your life paying off debt. Now that's like every third TikTok.
Right. So, oh, interesting.
Right. So students are really, and that would be another one, the access for applicants to connect with law school students over platforms like Discords and TikToks means they don't have to go through the marketing admissions process anymore. They can go straight to the source.
Right. I mean, I'm seeing it, as I said, in the law firm search world, right? We used, like, even, you know, it sounds quaint almost that when I was looking at firms, it was like you read Vault and that was it. And now it's much more personalized. There's a lot more information and there's a lot more access to people. And access, I mean, I'm always for access and like making the opaque transparent. That's sort of the fundamental premise of this podcast. But it does change the sort of general practices of all these institutions.
How institutions talk to students, how they market, for lack of a better word, themselves to students, and then what students are looking for and how they're able to directly access information. There's just much more information out there than when you applied. When you applied, you were getting information basically from schools or U.S. News. Now you're getting it from Law School Transparency, from, you know, hopefully FivyConsulting.com. We have, you know, obviously lots of data out there from the applicants themselves, from law school data. They create their own websites with data. So they're able to make more data-centric informations from the 509 report. That could go on and on and on. I'm glad I was able to mention our firm's website, but there's a thousand others out there, of course.
Sure. No, that's fascinating. Let's talk rankings, which is a different but related subject. And, you know, you mentioned that there's been this major change in how rankings data is compiled, the role that rankings play, what data goes into rankings. You and I mean, especially you, but me to a somewhat lesser extent, are sort of in this world. For someone who's listening, who has like no idea what rankings are or how they changed, what's the rankings 101 for 2024?
Okay. So if you have no idea or even a strong idea, what I would say first and foremost is keep in mind that rankings are ludicrous. There's a ranking for everything on the planet. There's rankings for the eggs, for the best quality eggs. I was looking at what different magazines rank things, right? So someone a long time ago realized that the human psyche, it loves to orderly rank things. So throw out that information. Even as a firm, when we were in our very beginning and no one knew our name, we quickly saw through analytics, if we said how to get into law school, you know, you get 1,000 people. If we said the top 10 ways to get into law school, you would get 12,000 people. And I could go on more, but I won't. There are many societal / psychological reasons that people crave rankings. Just because people crave them and therefore they impact behavior doesn't mean that they're helpful. The same dude who ranks law schools, every other med schools, education schools, undergrad, he's been doing it for 32 years. Can he name a 1L class? Can't imagine he can. Are the rankings accurate? Of course, one school isn't 5 better than another or 4 worse. Right. So I would say at the most basic level, just realize that rankings are a vehicle, but the vehicle is just not being built while it's driven and it's driving all over the place. The other thing is, one, you're in that you see hiring partners. So I used to be also a dean of career services. And something I started doing pretty quickly, I was traveling all over the country, meeting with hiring partners and managing partners, and I would ask them to name the top 10 law schools. None of them got it right. So then I went down to the top 6 schools. None of them got them right. Not once, and hundreds and hundreds. So I think what's comforting, so applicants get really, and sometimes students, caught up in rankings. Faculty get really caught up in rankings.
Absolutely.
Right. Yep. And again, there's a lot of psychological reasons for that. But the one thing that I think is positive is that on your typical given day, a hiring partner has no idea that if UVA went up 4 or down 4. They don't. They have in their mind, depending on the firm and the size of the firm and what they're looking for, a cluster of schools they think are great and good, they'll hire from, but they have no idea what the rankings are. So that's just the general overview. It's a more specific, I mean, I could expiate forever on this, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's helpful. I think that's helpful level setting, both of sort of why we have them. You know, maybe they're like the worst, but we can't think of anything better, or at least the law schools that want them and the firms that want them. But I also think the idea of like clusters is something that I've seen in practice that I think students don't see from the outside. All of that said, like the rankings haven't, you can correct me if I'm wrong. My perception is that the rankings haven't changed in terms of who's ranked where very much in the recent past, except to the extent you have the quote unquote T14, and the school I teach at sometimes falls in it and sometimes falls out of it. And then you have a couple of schools that have like jumped way up in the rankings and a couple of schools that have jumped way down, but otherwise the clusters are natural. And now all of that is changing. Is that an accurate assessment? Because I'm not sure it is anymore.
It's accurate except for the word natural. I would say the clusters were inorganic. And here's what I mean. Unlike most data science, you create the model, you get the data, and then you put the data in the model and it spews out. What US News admitted it to the Wall Street Journal, they do, they get the data, they run it through a model. If the model has wacky changes, they actually create a different model. And the reason why they do that is they don't want to delegitimize their rankings. So if they had Georgetown going from 14 to 47, it would threaten, people would say, well, this doesn't make sense. It wasn't that clustering wasn't natural. It was actually a little bit. And that's why it's been for so long, the T14, basically the T14. What happened this year is because of the boycott, which I'll just briefly explain.
Yeah, say more. Yeah, please.
Yeah. Yale dropped out and then Harvard dropped out. And by dropping out, obviously they're going to be ranked. US News has they have free will. They can rank people if they want. But what Yale said is we're not going to submit you the private unaudited data, because what was happening is schools finally got fed up. You had things like student expenditures per student, where on a random year, a school would all of a sudden go from like 19 to 1. And no one was auditing this data. US News was just accepting it. This was like moving schools up sizable spots in the rankings, and no one was on the same page for how they were accounting for things like expenditures for students. And schools were like, well, this is just, we're not on the same playing field. And depending on how you interpret this question or how principled you are in answering this question, you can just submit a number that is totally out of whack with every other law school. So schools got fed up. Yale said no more. On the same day, Harvard said no more. And then in rapid succession, a number of schools in the top 20. Now, in the past, Jonah, one or two schools had done this. One or two schools had said, we're not going to submit our data. This is crazy. And what US News had done in the past is just they normalized their data. They assigned them the data.
Right. When you're already making the model fit the data, it's not such a leap to say, well, we'll just make the data.
Exactly. But when you have a large portion of the top 20 schools not submitting the data, there's nothing to normalize with on. You don't have a critical mass. So US News had to then pivot radically. So what they did is and we've talked a little bit about this, is, you know, in part of their pivot, they had to get rid of all these private things. That gave them more weight for the employment bar passage. And they also, because schools were saying things like, well, a median LSAT, a median GPA doesn't reflect our class. like, you know, the span might be huge. So there were complaints on that end. So what US News did is they greatly diminished the LSAT and the GPA, also adding to the employment. So the big change in the rankings is employment, bar passage, ton, at the expense of LSAT. Outcomes matter at the expense of inputs. The other big change of interest is because it's all public, 75% of the data is public, 25% of the assessment scores, which are state almost the same every year. So people like me and others, once the 509s came out in December, we actually, this year, we could predict with incredible accuracy, almost down to exact accuracy, what the rankings are going to look like. So we can essentially leak the rankings in December. We have it on our website. So what's happening? On April 9th, we found out today, it's April 9th, the new rankings to come out. US News has to like introduce a new variable because they can't have people like me leaking the rankings. So there will be something new in there, like citation or diversity or predicted bar passage. We just don't know what it is, but there's going to be some new crazy, and that'll be interesting to see how it shakes things up.
Wow. I have so many questions. And first of all, we'll try to get this episode out before the rankings, because I think
April 9th. We now know the date.
Yeah, before April 9th, I will definitely try to get this. We are recording on March 19th. My goal will be to get it out before April 9th so that people can hear this. I mean, I have a bunch of immediate reactions, but one that I would love your reaction to my reaction to is this idea that we put in inputs that, because they're good inputs for the system, as opposed to like having a first principles discussion about like what makes the best law school, right? So like you threw out a couple of examples of things they could conceivably add, but like citation count and diversity are two incredibly different variables that would require schools to do incredibly different things. And so I guess part of me is, you know, shuddering at the idea of making the model fit the outputs. Like, that's just problematic. But haven't we lost the plot on making a decision about what makes a good law school?
It's not that we've lost it. We never had it. And before U.S. News, this predates both of us, but it was the Gorman Report. And the Gorman Report was even worse. And I'll give you an example. It had four categories. This is like in like 1970. So it was something like selectivity, which is admissions, faculty, employment, and I can't remember the fourth, money or whatever. And this is where it gets hilarious. This is how unscientific it was. You were Vanderbilt and you were ranked 15th overall. You were always ranked 15th on all of those four.
That doesn't make any sense.
They actually weren't even using data. They were just putting you in. Right. So we've never had the plot. And this is why I started with rankings are pretty absurd.
In terms of actual changes, so like I'm not speaking on behalf of my employer, anything like that, full disclosure, Georgetown is one of the schools that dropped out. What is the impact of this major shift going to be? We talked a little bit about it in the context of admissions. Where do you see the other impacts, having, I assume, spoken to a lot of people at schools and employers? Like, what's the consequences, I guess, of this shakeup?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because I guess it depends on what lens you ask it from. If you mean what are the consequences to students at schools, or if you mean how much are things going to change, how much are things going to bounce around. But if you're asking, which I think you're asking, okay, so schools boycotted, does this change anything? The answer is no. Again, people supersize the importance of rankings. And in law school, unlike business school and med school, U.S. News is the only player in town. So in our model, again, when the data came out in December, you have schools moving 40 places. Are there consequences to those schools for dropping 40 points and moving up 40? There shouldn't be, because they're not 40 worse than they were the day before. But because people have, for whatever reasons, a great interest in how things are ranked. And I actually just did a podcast on the psychology of rankings. So people can listen to that if they're like really want to go into like different, how you get your esteem from different areas and all this stuff. And right now, if U.S. News doesn't change things, they're going to be very volatile. So the more volatile, the more some schools are going to win the rankings game than ever before, and the more schools will lose the rankings game.
Yeah, and I'll put a link to that show in the show notes for anybody who's curious to take another more deep dive. I would be curious also to, what's the effect, do you think, on students, either students currently there or sort of recent grads, or you know, what's the effect to the people who this is all happening unbeknownst to them and with really, frankly, no reason why it happens to happen to them when they're in law school?
Yeah, I mean, I think the impact is, I'll give you an example. I went to Vanderbilt, as you noted at the intro. Vanderbilt undergrad went from something like 13 to 18 last year. And that was the first, they had been on a steady, steady rise. And you can track this. There's two researchers at Princeton. I think it's Toma and Cross who actually researched this. People tend to give the school more money if they're going up, less money if they're going down. We know for a fact, if your school moved, like Texas A&M Law School, that keeps moving up, 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 up. Well, what's happening? They're getting more and more and more and more applicants. They can be choosier and choosier and choosier. They can raise tuition, immutable laws of supply and demand. They can get higher, raise faculty salaries. You know, we live in an attribute-based economy. And what that means is, did my child go to Harvard? Do I drive a Jag? I'm not saying everyone gets their esteem or whatever from a tribute, but attributes matter, or Grey Poupon couldn't raise their prices. True story. And increased demand. It's called a Giffen good in business terms. Grey Poupon raised prices and demand increased. And because of rankings, law schools can do the same. You go up, up, up in the rankings and you can raise tuition, you can increase faculty salaries. Again, for these arbitrary reasons, life is easier when you're moving up in the rankings. And when you're a student, if your school drops 15 points, you catastrophize. Again, hiring partners don't know that the school dropped 15 points. But you hear the students, you see them. If their school drops from 20 to 35, it is human nature to catastrophize and say, oh my gosh, now I'm going to be shut out of Big Law because Big Law is not interested in my school anymore. So the word would be behavior. Rankings dramatically impact behavior. They're not real. Obviously, they're not real. Like, there's no way you could say Duke is better than UVA for Jonah. But they impact Jonah's behavior, perhaps. I don't know. Tell me, have they impacted your behavior?
Right. I don't know. I mean, I didn't get into either, so I didn't have to make that choice, and I'm happy to share that information. I mean, it's the most interesting part to me is the catastrophizing when actually maybe it doesn't matter is a really interesting point as well. And before we sort of pivot, the last question I want to ask is sort of bringing admissions and rankings back together now that we've level set both topics, which is, on the one hand, you and I can sit here and say, like, the rankings are silly, they're contrived, they're fake, they don't help. But when you're counseling people on admissions, I imagine part of that is they want to get into, like, the best school they can or the best school for them. How do you deal with that conversation of these rankings probably don't change that much, or they don't change that much within certain clusters, but I'm coming to you because I want to go to the best school? Like, how do you deal with that tension?
I mean, that's a great question. The first question we ask is, who's telling you it's the best school? Is it your parent's best school? Is it what your friends or your college or your pre-law advisor? So who's telling you it's the best school? And then, have you looked at how much your debt's going to be? Because who cares if you get into school number 4 and you have to pay the full tuition, or school number 5 and you're paying no tuition? Who cares about that 1-point ranking? And they get it. Like, when we put it in those terms, it's harder to overcome the inner circle influence. Well, my parents really want me to go to a top 14. It's harder to overcome that. But when you start talking about debt load versus a couple points in the rankings, all of a sudden you see people's minds clicking. We're lucky because our clients are with us for the whole year. So we develop trust between us, so that at the end of the cycle, when they have 7 hard decisions to make, it's their choice. We want them to have hard decisions. Our job literally is to give applicants hard decisions. But they deeply listen to the fact that we want them to visit schools. And guess what? If you're admitted, most schools are going to pay your trip. So the resources shouldn't be an inhibition unless you're working every day. Unless time resource is an inhibition, you should be able. So we're telling our clients, we're telling the market, visit, talk to people. You don't have to visit on Admitted Students Day. Of course, Admitted Students Day is scripted. I used to be in charge of these. I put this likable former CIA agent who was a law school professor at Vanderbilt doing the mock class because he was young and charming and he worked for the CIA. Is that a day in the life of law school? Of course not. You don't hang out with former CIA operatives. So, you know, visit on a Tuesday. You can visit on an admitted students program, but you can also visit any day. Visit on Tuesday or connect with people on a Discord. You now have access. And again, like we were talking about, you can talk to students online, and people aren't shy online. Of course not. You know, you don't even have to use your name. So that's one way now that you can counteract the rankings, is we can get students, applicants talking to law students and hearing from them about their experience at schools. And a lot of time, this is interesting, Jenica, you're hitting on something, a phenomenon we've seen. A lot of time, relative to 10 years ago, people will come to us with the top 3 and then they'll get into that top 3, and 6 months later, they'll go to their 5th or 6th school. And because they've heard from students at the top 3, maybe it's hyper-competitive, or, you know, it's not inclusive. For a lot of reasons, students change their minds during the admissions process. Versus when I started 26 years ago, man, if Georgetown was your top school, not only just my experience, the data suggested it was not going to drop out of your top school. Now they're shuffling all the time.
I mean, that's interesting, because that's what I'm seeing when those students come into my classroom and then apply to law firm jobs in their first or for their second summer. And they're coming to me for counseling because I did that work, right? Sort of on the side kind of counseling. The idea that you have 5 options, you're not necessarily going to choose the one that is the highest rank, is very common among my current students and was not very common when I was a student at the school I teach. So that is a shift that I have seen happen firsthand over the last sort of 5, 6, 7 years. And it sounds like it's not that different than the law school admissions process as well.
Similar shift, and that shift is real. And I think that's a good shift. And I think the law school admissions shift towards who are you as a person versus what are your numbers is a good shift. So I actually think the pendulum's always swinging. So 10 years from now, the pendulum might be back toward numbers. But right now, the pendulum is swinging in the right direction.
Right. And it maybe creates good incentives, right? Because it incentivizes the schools to be more welcoming and doing the things the students want to do. It incentivizes the firms to care about the things that their junior associates are doing. And it might create actually a positive feedback loop as opposed to a negative feedback loop.
I mean, we mentioned mental health. There's a lot of law schools that have people who specialize in mental health. when I was working in law school, none that I was aware of did. And that's because the market asked for it.
So let's turn to mental health, because I don't want to leave that, and we have a little time left. I mean, this is something that I know you've been talking about more, but have been talking about for a long time. Admissions, rankings, counseling, that makes sense. Why did you come to this work of mental health as such an important part of your personal sort of mission?
You know, when you're in your teens and 20s and the research shows, you're focused on the outside world, and it makes sense. And actually, for evolutionary survival reasons, it makes sense. When you hit a certain age, you're much more likely to start looking inward. And I just happened to do that. And my background is kind of interesting. Maybe some people can relate. Maybe a lot of people can't. But when I was a child, I wasn't really good at many things, or at least I perceived that. I kind of shelled up in my room and read fantasy books. I had friends, but I didn't do sleepovers. I got bullied a lot. So a teacher in middle school, I don't think we called them professors. He happened to take interest in me as a person. And I think he could tell that I probably suffered more in my head than I should in reality. In other words, I was probably better at things than I realized. And he told me that. And he was like, you know, Mike, like you can do, I'll never forget this. This is a true story. You can do more pushups than anyone in this school if you wanted to. So what did I start doing? I went to my basement and I started doing pushups. And then, I'm not making this up, 1,000 pushups a day. And for whatever reason, that timed with sort of like a spur to my athleticism and growth. And next thing I knew, I was the fastest person in my school. And this is now freshman year of high school. So what did I start doing then? And this is, by the way, what I'm talking about is unhealthy. So we're going to get
right.
there.
No, right. I, it's not a wow, congratulations. It's
correct. At the time, right. I thought it was. And this is why mental health is so important to me now, because at the time I thought this was what mattered. This was the only good fight there is. So I started, and you and I talked on the phone once, and so I know you know this. I started sneaking out of my parents' house at like 1:30 in the morning. I remember it was like the old garages, and I would like creak it open, and I would, you know, drive the car slowly out. I would drive to the track, the high school track, and I would run from like 1:30 to 3:30 until I got physically sick or I collapsed. And that became an addiction. So in other words, if I miss that, I would feel, the definition of addiction is continued use despite negative consequences. So if I miss that, I would feel horrible. So I would continue doing that. Obviously, there's negative consequences to what I was doing. But so that's called performance-based esteem. And looking back, my high school girlfriend didn't know I was scoring touchdowns or what 40-yard dash or 200-yard. It seemed so important to me at the time, but my closest friends, what they wanted and what I was unable to do was say things like, I love you or I care about you. Because all of my esteem was conditioned upon, did I win the race or score the touchdown? And guess what? If your esteem is totally conditioned on something external, there's always going to be someone that comes up who's better. Always. If you have a bad day, in your performance-based esteem condition, then your mood that day, you're going to feel bad about yourself. So I was like, I don't want to feel bad about myself anymore. I'm not winning races anymore. So we started having, just by luck, world-famous psychologists on our podcast. Dr. Gabor Mate, the world's leading expert on addiction. Dr. Anna Limpy, who's been on the social network at Stanford, who talks about dopamine. Daniel J. Lieberman, who wrote The Molecule of More about dopamine. Kristen Neff about compassion, all of these things that understandably your typical 22-year applicant, they're not thinking about self-compassion. They're not thinking about Terry Real, who's Oprah's therapist, who's been on Oprah, who's on our podcast, is talking about where do you get your esteem and how you get it from yourself. I didn't take the time, I didn't take a second, Jonah, when I was 22 to think about these things. And my second half of my life, as cliche as it sounds, obviously, I have a personal life too, but my life's work would be if we can get more people at a younger age to think about, why am I processing the world like this? Why am I being so hard on myself like this? Because, you know, people are hard on themselves. People suffer. My book that's coming out this year is titled, We're All a Bit Messy. We are. But you can improve that. As much as I believe we're all a bit messy, I believe even more we're all resilient. And if you're willing to look inward, you can handle it.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, thank you for sharing your powerful story, which I'm a big believer that sharing our stories a lot, like, creates a sort of permission cycle for people to think in different ways. That's why I spend so much time dedicated to this podcast, but it takes two to tango. And so I appreciate you sharing your story. You know, one of the amazing parts of this being a part of your focus is what you have done in your whole career, right, is pick people who can be in or out and help people get admitted. And those are the moments I feel like where even some of the people who have the most thoughtful approach to their own mental health, you start telling yourself stories. Like, I'll speak personally, I do that all the time. Also, applying to law school was one of the hardest things I ever did, not because the application process was hard, was because I was more unsuccessful, quote unquote, at that than almost anything I had done previously. And frankly, almost anything I did after the fact. And that, like, took a real toll on me. And I know it takes a toll on students. And I guess I'm curious, for someone who's going through the admissions process, or someone who's recently graduating from law school and not getting the job maybe they thought they wanted or deserved or anything else, what else can we do? How else can we reframe?
What you mentioned, rejection, what is the admissions process? Hardly anyone goes 10 for 10. And these are people who have not been rejected or not used to being rejected. Right. So like, there are evolutionary reasons why, you know, thousands of years ago, if you were rejected, you got kicked out of the pack and you died. So humans that lived and passed on their genes were the humans that felt rejection the most, because if you could sense rejection coming, that meant you could survive. We don't need that gene anymore. The pack doesn't matter. You can be left, but you can't be abandoned in today's world. So rejection is a supersized gene in our heads that mattered for the human species, that doesn't matter now, but we feel it now more than ever before. Like Dr. Guy Winch, 30 million TED Talk views for his TED Talk. He was on our podcast talking about how to overcome rejection. It's probably one of the most useful. I could do a podcast on how to do a personal statement and it can get thousands and thousands of views, but that's going to help you for a cycle. Go listen to Dr. Guy Winch talk about how to handle rejection, and that's going to help you for the rest of your life.
Yes. I mean, 100%. And then you get to law school, and what do? We put everybody on a curve, right? Which creates winners and losers by definition. And then we have them go through job searches and law journal and moot court and a bunch of other competitions. And then you enter a profession, which is, at least in litigation posture, a zero-sum game where one side wins and one side loses. Building that resiliency, I think, is such a powerful moment, because if you can't handle rejection, it's very hard to be a successful and a happy lawyer.
Yeah, there's reasons why we pick topics like handling rejection, self-compassion, self-esteem, because like imposter syndrome, like all of these things matter so much to the people we're talking to on a daily basis that we go out and find the world's experts on these. And we've been lucky enough to have many of them on the podcast. We're not just like throwing darts at the board. Like Dr. Gabor Maté, the world's leading expert on addiction, why was he on our podcast? Because as you know, what happens at law firms, they're making these people stay up and work 20-hour days, 6 months in a row. So when you're tired, you're more apt to become addicted. And then people become addicted to Adderall or other substances to keep them going, going, going. But it crushes them in the long term. It crushes them.
And I guess my question is, how do we make progress? And I'm not saying how do we like solve this problem that we know exists both in the profession, in the pre-profession, in all of those places. You know, one area that I've seen of progress is, as you mentioned, like law schools taking this seriously and law firms taking this seriously and bringing in the right people. Where are we on the progress for responding to these challenges, which we know exist?
I think we're losing, but it's for societal, like social media has taken a huge toll. From the moment you can look over your parent's shoulder, you can see how popular they are. Then by definition, it's called transgenerational trauma, how popular you are through them. So the fact that we have more downtime than ever before, that might surprise you, but as a human species, we're not surviving. I'll tell you a fascinating study. A guy named Robert Sapolsky, one of the smartest guys on the planet, he won the Genius Award, studied new age versus old age primates in Africa. And the old world primates, like childbirth rates, they spent 18 hours a day finding food. They basically had to survive. They had to survive, just like humans 100,000 years ago. The new world primates, exact opposite. They had it easy. Like, you know, they knew how to store food and save food, and they had 18 hours a day, the exact opposite. And the hypothesis was the stress levels in the old world monkeys who had to survive was going to be way off the charts. You could measure this by cortisol. it was the exact opposite. And the reason being, the monkeys that had 18 hours to sit around and do nothing just annoyed each other and got on each other's nerves and had things like imposter syndrome. So because we are not surviving, because we're in our own heads, we're losing this battle. But because we have time to think about this, there are beautiful minds out there doing amazing work and research in this field. My Audible can't have enough books on self-care. The number of incredibly insightful researchers who are fighting the good fight for people's well-being, and it's accessible to all of them. We just need to open up people's eyes and say, hey, it matters to get in a good law school. What matters a lot more is have a good life. Don't worry about what your resume says. Worry about what your eulogy is going to say.
Wow. Normally, my last question always is, what's one piece of advice for people entering our profession? I think you may have just given yours.
We could end there.
You know, we could end there. I mean, truly, like, I couldn't, I mean, I think that is such a, you know, I've had this conversation with many guests in many areas of practice of sort of, are type A people attracted to law, or does law make people type A, or, you know what I mean? At the end of the day, is we are in a profession that is having a mental health crisis that is very similar in some ways to the broader society, but also uniquely acute. And I think a lot of what you just talked about and what you're talking about on your podcast and in your writing is just an important piece of that. So I'm very grateful. Any parting words, any places people can find you, anything you want to share with listeners before we close out?
Yeah, we're easy. I won't overhype us. We're easy to find, you know, Spivey Consulting. In the parting words, I think what's in there, live for your eulogy, don't live for your resume.
Amen. Well, Mike, this was super fun and it's been great to get to know you. Shout out to former guest and my friend, Rob Cacasey, for connecting us. And hopefully we'll find a way to have further conversations and keep this conversation going.
We are, because we're going to have you on our podcast. So Fast Check by Spivey, and you're coming. So we're going to make it happen.
I'll be there. It'd be my great honor and great privilege. So yeah, well, thank you so much for taking the time, Mike, and just be well.
My last parting thought is, please let you do 90% of the talking when you're on my podcast, because I feel like I did not, and I'm not used to this. So I'm going to interview you. Deal?
Totally. We'll turn the tables. It's a really different, trust me, I've been on both sides of the mic. It is a totally different experience. And it's a good reminder to anybody listening, if you've never tried it, podcasting is actually a fascinating medium and a really great way to connect with really great people. So I couldn't recommend it enough. And with that, I will say goodbye to everybody. And thanks again to Mike. Be well.
Thanks, Jonah. Be well.
Again, I am Jonah Perlin, and this is the How I Lawyer podcast. Thanks to podcast sponsor Law Pods for their expert editing. If you're a lawyer considering starting your own podcast, definitely check them out at lawpods.com. And thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, I hope you'll consider sharing it with friends and colleagues or on social media. And of course, if you haven't already done so, please sign up for the email list at howilawyer.com or subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. As always, if you have comments, suggestions, or ideas for the show, please reach out to me at howilawyer@gmail.com or @JonahPerlin on Twitter. Thanks again for listening, and have a great week.